Okay, Anthony, can you tell me how your interest in energy and renewable energy began?
I think it's always been there, and I took early retirement, so it gave me the opportunity to develop my interests. But actually, it goes back quite a long way, really, because years and years ago, my wife and I tried to find an electric car that would be sensible to drive, and we found a Norwegian electric car that was being tried out in London. So we hired it in central London and drove out to Trina's mother, who was in hospital in Amersham, and asked the hospital if we could plug it in. And they said no one's ever asked us to do that before, and they were very concerned that if we plugged it in, we would drain the hospital of power. But so we've had a great interest in living more sustainably, and now we've got two electric cars, so and we have done away with all the other cars, so that's good. And but it's been something that's been there. And as I on our we've been here about 10 years, and we used to live in Farnham, and we put some solar panels on the roof in Farnham, and those worked, and probably those were some of the very early ones. And I used to teach in the Open University at weekends, and they said to me, well, you could do a course free of charge so that you understand the student experience. So so I did a course which was a year long on energy for a sustainable future, roughly. And it was very useful because when it came to this house, which we found as a shell, and finishing it off so that we had it just we had as much new technology in it that helped us live more sustainably that we could. That course was incredibly useful, and gave me a set of knowledge which I wouldn't have otherwise had. It's very interesting now that we've created a solar farm, then I'm being asked to help lots of other people across the region to do those, as well as doing my own projects. So I'm helping the Future South Partnership, which is all the local authorities from Portsmouth to Southampton, plus the larger companies, plus the universities. And their board came to our solar farm, and they said it would be wonderful if we could have a project like this in each of our local authority areas. And so that's another project which I'm sort of working on in the background. Between that aspiration and making it happen is a bit of a long journey, but we're working on some interesting projects. If they come to fruition, will be newsworthy. Yeah. And that's that. But the house here doesn't have a boiler. It has a ground heat source pump, which is buried under the pipes buried under the garden, and we have solar panels on the roof. How did the solar farm come about? Well, my wife, who's sitting in the chair across there, said, I don't want any more solar panels, and especially those on the lawn. And so the ones on the lawn are now on a shed. And I started looking around for a field, and I talked to a local estate agent who showed me a couple of fields, and they weren't really suitable because they were too overlooked, and one of them was downwind of a recycling plant, and so you'd have lots of dust in the air and all these things. So, well, I do have another field which isn't on the market, but so he showed me that, and it's 12.5 acres, and it faces south, and it is flat, and it was perfect, and it was an old gravel pit, and so you weren't taking any land out of food production. The people who owned it were a family trust who'd got quite wealthy on the basis of all the gravel that had been extracted, and they thought I wanted to build houses on it, so it took quite a long time to get it out of them, but we managed to do that. And And then I formed a cooperative called West Solent Solar Cooperative to do the project, because I've seen how well cooperatives work in Denmark, because my wife is half Danish and we go there quite a lot. And it was really useful to do it that way, because I work with Transition locally, Transition New Forest, and Friends of the Earth and so on. And so the board I built had, which is about seven people, are all local people. There's a couple of engineers, including one who used to work for the oil industry, so that's good. And we had an ex-corporate lawyer who was very useful for legal agreements, and we had someone who was head of Transition New Forest, and all the sort of skills that I didn't have, but you need to build a team around you with complementary skills. And in my case, I started my life as a town planner. I went to business school, and I worked in branded in industries. I worked in business planning and finance, and all that experience came into play on this project. Because it was a cooperative and not a commercial project, well, it is commercial, but it is for people, owned by local people. Nobody objected to the planning application, and for renewable energy, I think that was quite an achievement. And we went along to the neighbours before we put the planning application in and talked to them, and some of the neighbours actually invested in the project and became members of the cooperative. And that's really helpful, because it's 2 miles from here, and so one of the people who invested, one of the neighbours, actually looks over the field. So we've got our own guardian there. But it was from the vision of the solar farm to actually linking to the grid, it took about 12 months. But it was a fairly hard-working 12 months, and as I say, we had a team that was working really quite hard on this, it had its challenges. The English Nature read our ecological report and said, it says there is the option, there's the potential for geese to overwinter on your field. Potential. And we'd been looking at the field for a while, and we thought, next door is a gravel pit which has been filled as a lake, and that's where all the geese are, because there's water, and they make an approach to that field from over our field, but we've never seen geese on our field, and even now we haven't seen. So, and in the end, we invited English Nature to come and have a look at the field and talk to us there, and that was the key to unlocking that. And and then just before the project was completed, SSE said, oh, we can't do it, we can't connect it in time. So I contacted the chief executive's office and talked to them, not angrily, but just, you know, reasonably assertively, and they sorted it, and suddenly it was possible, you know. And so you've got to be, you've got to have a vision and then have the determination to see it through. And so we connected to the grid on the 27th of June 2014. And it was a very happy occasion, but the whole process had been happy. There was a double story office on the site, and we had weekly meetings with the people who were building it, and one of my colleagues even made a cake when we did the G59 test, and it was a good team, but we worked with Solar Century, for the EPC contract, and they used a local contractor based in Chichester who did a fantastic job, and they nothing fazed them. But I think our site was relatively simple to some of the ones they've done, and so we raised the money, which was about 2.6 million, in about 6 weeks. And the BBC were incredibly helpful, because we were the first sort of community-owned project in Hampshire, and we are wholly owned by the cooperative. There's no external banks involved. It's just purely a community project. We did do a community bond, because this is a retirement area. And when you went along to many of the people locally and said, it's a 20-year project, and they said, well, well, I'm sort of like 85, and I'm not sure that's the right product for me. But then we came up with a 5-year bond, paying 5%, and that went very well. So yeah, so the BBC were incredibly helpful. They filmed us when it was just a field with a vision, and this went on to the local news at 6 o'clock, you know. And then they filmed us when the first solar panels went on, and then they filmed us when we had our first open day. And and actually I had people come out of the blue saying, I was at school with you and I saw you on BBC, and so I've had contact with people I haven't seen for years. And other people said, we saw it on the BBC, so we thought it must be real, it's not a scam. It was very interesting. And I talked about the office block there, which gave a view over the whole site. And the BBC said, well, look, when the office block's gone, how are you going to see over the whole site? And so there was quite a lot of sort of earth that had come out of the trenches that was sort of piled around the place. So the contractor said, well, we'll just spread it. And so we said, no, why don't you put it in one point? So we now have an observation hill, and where you can see over the whole site, which you'll see later on. And but we've actually taken a coach load of residents from the local Quaker care home, average age 92 and a half, who backed their coach up this hill and then staggered out to the other end, because the whole thing about a community owned solar farm is that it's open for visitors. And we've had probably about 20 plus schools come to visit, and but we've also had other social groups, and we've made quite a lot of arrangements to make it more interesting for them. We have all sorts of cables that are buried under the ground, which we've got samples of, so you can see, you know, what's buried under the ground and what materials it's made of. And we've planted a hedge all the way around the field. And it's not to hide it, it's to produce a wildlife corridor, because we're trying to improve the biodiversity, because our ecological survey said whatever you do has to be better than it is at the moment, because it was a gravel pit. They just put the soil back on and put a sort of seed mix on. And so we're working with the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust to improve the biodiversity of the field. And so we planted this hedge around, and on the right hand side we put a call out to the community, and the community planted it, and we got whips and tubes from the the Woodland Trust. So and we needed, I think, 3 attempts to complete that side, and we had help in making the application for the grants, and we got the funds to do that, and the materials to do it. And then on the other side we used a local contractor, because I think we probably got a bit tired by then. And so we now have a hedge that goes all the way around. and we got the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust to plant wildflower seeds over the whole site, which is really good. Only the people who were contracted to cut the grass didn't read the instructions or weren't given the instructions. So we said, cut a meter in front of all the panels because we don't want stuff shading the bottom row of panels. And they actually strimmed the whole 12 acres, including the bit in front of it where we have a bee shed and so on. And it was awful. But it was sufficiently early in the season where the Wildlife Trust said, well, I think there'll be a second flowering and I think that we'll be all right. And then we also thought, well, rather than get lawnmowers in and people to strim everything, perhaps our original vision was to have sheep on the site. And we found, one of my colleagues found a local shepherd who'd been given, I think it was 3 sheep as a wedding present. And now they've got rather more. And so we don't charge them, they just come along. And they've done a brilliant job of keeping the weeds under control as well as the grass. But we had to put fences around the inverter clusters because we've got 65 distributed inverters. And there's a little story behind that as well, because we said to the neighbours, it will be silent in operation. And then one of the people who tendered for the business said, well, you could have a central inverter. And we said, what's the noise profile of that? And it was quite noisy, basically. And so you'd hear it over a reasonable distance. And so we've got 65 inverter clusters. And so we've had to build fences around those so that the little wires that sort of go down underneath them can't be chewed by the sheep. But when we go down to the site later on, I think I think this is the last couple of days that the sheep are on this time of year, because the flowers are starting to come up and we don't want them to chew those. And and we've also got a composting toilet, which we got a grant from the lottery for. There was one of these chemical toilets which the contractors put in and was left there, but it's quite a windy site, and so it kept on blowing over and then wasn't very effective after that. And also it was chemical, so we got this grant and put in a composting toilet which works remarkably well, and it's got no power and no water. And it doesn't smell. And we have we said in our prospectus that we would have a community grant fund after 5 years, when things sort of settle down. But actually, it's quite a sunny part of the country, and we generated rather more than we thought we would. So we introduced our grant fund after 18 months, and we work quite closely, as I've said, with schools, and a local school here, who I've helped with a solar roof a few years ago, phoned me up and said, well, we've got this new nursery unit and it's a long way from the drains. Any ideas? And so I said, as it happens, we've just put a composting toilet into our solar field. Why don't you come and have a look at that? So the head teacher and the school admin person and some others came along, and as a result of that we funded a composting toilet for the nursery school, part of the local primary school, and they're thrilled, and they've got 2 little steps up, and it's just for the nursery children, and the rest of the children are quite envious because it works well. And a fantastic project, and we wanted to make a project that the local community would be proud of, and I'm pretty sure that we've got there now. And I said that we were trying to make it more interesting for schools and others, so I have built a solar railway and the solar railway is on a board. This is the second version of it, because the first board was rather too heavy. And the solar railway works off one solar panel, which we got a local contractor to give to us. And it's G gauge, which is about that, you know, it's about 3 inches wide, the track, and it goes, and it works really well. And our main problem was trying to slow the train down, because it went round a bit too fast. But one of the principles of a cooperative, co-ops help each other, and so one of the guys I know at West Mill Wind Farm, who've got a solar railway, I contacted him, and he had a device built in China which slows the train down. So that works really well. And we've got some beehives on the site, and that's not been a great success so far, because the person who's got the bees put them on, and the wasps attacked two of the hives and killed the bees off, which was really disappointing. But there's still one hive down there with bees in, but we haven't had any honey out of it yet.
Are you finding an improvement in the biodiversity around the site?
Very significantly, yes. One of the things we found last year were a couple of bee orchids, which are really rare, and we can't claim credit for those, because apparently they have a dormancy of about 8 years, and so it must have been somewhere in the soil that was dumped back on. And it looks like there are bees on a plant, you know, it's the same sort of effect. And we've seen quite interesting behaviours from birds, for example. We've had underneath the solar panel arrays are microclimates. It's slightly moister, it's darker. We've had ducks who are sort of almost like hiding from some of the hawks that are sort of circling above looking for something to have a go at. So there are some animals which hide under the panels, some feed there, because as well as a microclimate, there are more insects there. And we're working with the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust to do a monitoring program to prove that solar farms do improve the biodiversity. And we're doing butterfly surveys, we're doing bee surveys, we're doing bird surveys, and I think this year we're going to do an insect survey for the first time. But the bees and the birds, the current surveys we've done, using our members being trained by the Wildlife Trust, have shown some significant improvements so far. And this is only after about 2.5 years, so it's coming on very nicely. But I think, you know, planting the wildflowers is largely responsible for that, but also the microclimate underneath the panels. And then we've had, you see, swallows diving low over the panels to hoover up insects as well. It's because really, it not many people use the site. We have visitors maybe once a week. There are contractors on site once a fortnight, so it's quite peaceful. It's quiet, and there's a lot of space for wildlife to move in and be safe. And we have a deer-proof fence that goes all the way around the site, and that keeps out the larger animals, and so it's a fairly safe environment for wildlife. And so we hope we've got a sort of a 10-year program to do this, and we hope to publish some reports that just show how good for biodiversity solar farms are. But you have to look you have to look after them. And the Wildlife Trust are saying, because the site is only about a mile from the sea, that you have a sort of marine version of a wildflower meadow because the plants are different than you would find a couple of miles inland, and but they can identify plants which I can't. But they have taken local council. We had an open day for local councillors, and we had district councillors and county councillors and people from the National Park Authority and others come to the site. And the Wildlife Trust people took them round and pointed out the things which I wouldn't recognise that they were very excited about. And some of the councillors were fascinated by what they were being told. And so that's... I'm sure that we will be able to prove to the doubting world that they are good. And yeah... No, it's good.
And the electricity that's generated on the site, is that used locally or does it go back into the national grid?
It is used locally. We can't sell our electricity to local people because we're not allowed to by the way that the electricity system works in this country. It seems rather strange. There is a cable run of three cables that goes across the site, which you'll see in a minute, and I was quite surprised when the connection was made, because it's like they clip a cable onto each of the three wires, and you think they're quite small wires and there's 2.4 megawatts of stuff going through there, and but it seems to work. And so it goes, that cable run goes into Pennington and Lymington, where we can supply enough electricity for about 600 households, and that means that all our electricity is used probably within about 1.5 miles. And it doesn't go onto the national grid, where you lose 10% of it as you trunk it across the country. It just is used locally. And so what we have is a relatively modest embedded solar facility owned by local people and providing electricity to local people. We sell our electricity to Cooperative Energy, which is part of Mid Counties Co-op, and they have what they call a user chooser function. So, because they buy renewable energy from a number of other renewable sites, and so if you go onto their website and you're one of their customers, you can actually choose which of the renewable generators you want your electricity to be supplied by. And so I think about 120 of our members have clicked on West Solent. And so they know that their electricity, well, essentially it's matched to their demand, but you know, they could actually go one stage further than that and say, yes, well, we're buying, it's the best we can do to buy West Solent's electricity. But so we are a cooperative selling our electricity to another cooperative, and that seems entirely right.
People in the area, do you think it's enhanced their understanding of renewable energy and made them think a little bit more about the impacts that we are having on our climate?
I'm absolutely convinced that it's had a big impact on the schools that have come to our site. But I also think, as I said before, it's had an effect on the councillors, and it's had an effect on the people who are working with the councils in this part of the country. There's very little generation in this area. We import most of our electricity from the national grid. And there is a great aspiration to try and become more self-sufficient in renewable energy. One of the things that disappoints me, and I actually wrote to Theresa May about this, is that there was an offshore wind farm proposed called Navitas Bay, which was 9 miles out from Bournemouth and the Isle of Wight, and would have been enough electricity for 900,000 households. But the local Conservatives didn't like it, and so it was turned down by the government. It's the only offshore wind farm that's been turned down, and it's down to local Conservative that I'm, you know, I'm not impressed by some of that resistance. And there was some concerns because there was a 35-mile cable run, but then we've got gas pipelines that, you know, go across the countryside around here, and you wouldn't know that they were there after a couple of years. It just can grow over, and that would have been the same with this. And it's somehow that renewable energy is seen as something new and dangerous, whereas fossil fuel industry is, has been there, and people have grown up for it, and therefore they're prepared to put up with all the things, the same things that happen there, with new cables going up. But actually you have oil spills, and you have big power stations. We've got a big power station that's just been decommissioned over on the Solent, and you can see it from the whole of the New Forest National Park, because it's got huge chimneys. And I tried to put a solar farm next door to it on a site that the local council has, and it was, I think, we were proposing a 4-megawatt farm there, and the SSE, who do the local grid round here, said there's no capacity on the grid there. You can have 270 kilowatts, not 4 megawatts, which, you know, just wrecked the whole project. And while there are huge cables, you need to, for a sort of embedded generation of 2 or 3 megawatts, you need to have the local distribution network. And but when you're on the end of the line, which you are on the coast, it's a challenge sometimes. We were very lucky in the SSE upgraded the line that we're on a year before we got there. Thank goodness. But that was something that they did, which we didn't know about. But I'm very grateful for that. But the grid round here is compromised, and it's quite difficult to find sites that you can link to. And we had another project where it was in the national park area, and the grid connection was over capacity, so they put you on a waiting list and said, well, you can't have any because there's various people ahead on the queue on you, and we're not going to upgrade anything. Then we employ grid consultants who know them very well, who somehow unlocked it. And so you need to have the right experts helping you sometimes. And but that one was rejected by the National Park Authority, which is a shame, because it would have made the biggest employer in the National Park Authority carbon neutral, and they're owned by a Danish company, and it would have been brilliant for them. But the it was a very strange decision, because the decision notice said it's very well hidden, but the trees might get diseased, or they might blow down in a storm, in which case it might become a bit more visible. And you think, what planet are some of these people on? And is it the planet that's going to be sustainable? But anyway, there we are. That was not to be. But I am working now with a project with the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust, where they've bought a couple of farms, and I was taken to see one of the sites, and they've got a really good barn there where we can put about 30 kilowatts on it. And so that's what I'm currently working on, and I hope that works well, because it will be good, because it's an unused roof and doesn't affect the farming at all. In fact, it gives us the ability to provide electricity to the farm as well, so it will be good. And there's also the potential for a microgrid to some local houses, but I think we'll get it built first before we start thinking of microgrids, because I don't want to be a completely pioneer, but I want someone else to have done it first. But it's a beautiful part of the country, and it won't affect anyone, but it will be a good project if we can get it done.
Are you finding that, do you think that the process by which you can develop these projects is hampered more now than it was when you started because of changes to feed-in tariffs?
Yeah, it's... it is quite difficult now because the Conservatives have taken most of the subsidy away. I think the current subsidy rate on feed-in tariff for a ground-based one is less than a penny per kilowatt hour. And the price of panels was coming down quite nicely, and then we went through Brexit. And then the exchange rate changed, and suddenly solar panels are 20 cents more expensive. And so the government have made it incredibly difficult. The Financial Conduct Authority have made it very difficult as well, because they will not register any new cooperatives for renewable energy, which is, again, very odd, because this is the only country that interprets the international cooperative rules that way. And it's a great puzzle to most of the cooperative, not all of them, because there's some dyed-in-the-wood cooperative people as well. But the main thing is that the withdrawal of subsidies was very rapid, and we had 6 months from when we were pre-accredited for the feed-in tariff to raise the money and build our solar farm, and it was frantic. We did it with 3 days to spare, and then I think it was then changed. The Conservative government, when they had the Liberals as in the partnership, was calm, it was broadly supportive of renewable energy, down to the Liberals. Now this is just a Conservative government, and the Liberals got hammered for their part in the previous administration. The government have gone very against renewable energy. They've stopped onshore wind effectively, completely. They've taken away the subsidies from solar, in terms of solar is now outside the renewable obligation certificate, which essentially is closed. And now you have this contracts for difference thing, which is designed for very large companies, and that's something very difficult for community energy to work with. So community energy is left with fairly small rooftop projects. Well, maybe, you know, you can get 100 kilowatts on a roof, but it's some of the. But there were a lot of ground-based projects of the size that we are that were waiting to go. That some of them even had planning permission, and they. I'm helping one or two of them now because they've got planning permission. That they can't find an economic model to make it work so they can raise the money to build it. And there are ways that you can find a customer who can take electricity behind the wire so you don't go through the grid at all, and you don't, and that's a without subsidy solution that might work. And I have suggested some things to them which hopefully will work. But you know, to get planning permission in some of these areas was really difficult, and they got it, and they, I think they even went to appeal. And you think it is down to the rapid reduction in subsidies, and I don't think that the costs of installing these things has come down to the extent that makes it easy to do now. And I've got one or two fields that I would quite like to put solar panels on, but I'm just keeping those in the background, right? Waiting for a more supportive administration. I'm not sure we're going to get one, but we might.
As opposed to nuclear power.
Yeah.
Massive subsidies.
Well, there's still subsidy for fossil fuels, and there's still enormous subsidy for the new nuclear projects. And yet they've taken the subsidy away from renewable energy. And we have, in this country, formidable renewable resources. Germany's got huge amounts of wind power, but we've got more wind than Germany. Why aren't we doing wind turbines? Well, we are offshore, but offshore is quite a lot more expensive and a lot more difficult to maintain. And I think most of them are new, and we haven't seen what's involved with some of them as they get a bit more rusty. We're quite... we've got a beach up on our local beach. And we have to replace the padlock every year because it rusts. And you put Vaseline in it and you put bags around it and you try every trick in the trade, but it rusts. Mm. And so offshore wind farms, we probably will have to see some significant maintenance on them. Whereas onshore wind farms, I'm on the board of... a cooperative wind farm in Peterborough, and there's a lot more maintenance in a wind farm than there is in a solar farm, because you've got gearboxes and you've got things going round all the time, whereas ours don't move. But actually it's relatively straightforward compared to offshore, and you haven't even got enough boats, I don't think, to get out to some of these places to do them. But we've got lots of onshore facilities, and as I say, our site is incredibly windy, and we've actually had some wind damage to our solar farm last year, I think it was, where there was a 109-mile gust offshore the Isle of Wight by the Needles, which is only about a mile from where we are. And so several arrays on the windward side of our site, instead of being 18 inches above the ground, were touching the ground because the framework underneath was bent by the wind, or a wind pushing them down. And it was, and then you find that the insurance you've got isn't quite proper insurance, and they say, well, we ignore the first 10 days of loss of generation and the first £5,000 of losses. So we had about a £10,000 lost, and we got about £1,500 back from the insurers. And you think, what's insurance for? Anyway, but yeah, so it's a windy site. But if I'd gone to the local community and said, I think we want to put a wind turbine in here, they would have shot me down in flames, because you can see it. And isn't it, it's a bit inconsistent somewhere, but... And I think it's about showing people that these things are okay, and I think that that's why we've concentrated on schools, because schools are growing up with this technology. So a lot of the schools around here have been to our solar farm. A lot of them have got solar panels on the roofs of their school. The local school here, which I helped, have got a 10 kilowatt array on their nursery block. So from aged 3 or 4, they know that, and we got their inverter with the big display on it in the main corridor, so that they know that their power is coming from stuff on their roof, and it's tangible, and you can go and you can see it and you can touch it. You know, that's the nature of renewable energy. And so if you grow up with it, and as you go further north, probably from the Midlands upwards, you'll find a lot more wind turbines because people are used to them. And it's windier up there as well. But it is remarkably windy on the coast. And so I think there is scope for some wind turbines along the south coast, but I'm not brave enough to go up there and spend a lot of money trying to prove to the community that, or the planners or the government, that we need... Well, I don't think it would be possible at the moment.
Do you also, when you're talking to the community and talking to children, talk about behaviour change in relation to energy use?
Yes, we do, and we talk a lot of the work we're doing with our grant fund is about reducing electricity consumption and making visible the electricity that's being used, and Hampshire have a online monitoring system for schools, which we've worked with. It's not perfect, but it some of the schools' consumption at night time is remarkably high. And so by making some of these things visible, and another grant we got from the lottery was for a thermal imaging camera. And so you can see exactly where the holes are in the windows and the doors, and where the lack of insulation is, and where you think a wall's been properly insulated, you can see where it has been and where it hasn't been with these thermal imaging cameras. And so one of my colleagues runs what she calls the Schools Energy Project, which she gets funding for from Southern Water have been particularly helpful at the moment. And so she does school assemblies, and she has competitions for schools to come up with energy saving ideas. It has gone wrong in a couple of places, because some of the children got really enthusiastic, and we have what are called eco warriors in the schools, and they went home and turned their parents' computers off, and all sorts of other things they turned off, which the parents didn't necessarily appreciate. But So the new generation are coming through knowing that these things can be, electricity is a scarce resource and can be reduced. And they've, you know, we've also shown them electric cars, and so we have with the local transition movement, we've got energy monitors so that people can see what they're actually using. And I think I'm quite hopeful for the rollout of smart meters, because smart meters are meant to be showing people what they're actually consuming, and it's quite surprising, you know, what consumes most electricity. We had a smart meter from British Gas, because they put in one of our recharging units, and they said, well, we've got this new tariff that redefines off-peak as 20 hours a day, but we don't want you to charge your electric car from 4 o'clock to 8 o'clock. So it was like 10p for the rest of the time and 18p for the 4 hours that you to try and put you off there and shift your consumption to when there's surplus capacity on the grid. And that was fine. And then they cancelled it. And I phoned them up and said, why did you cancel this really good tariff? And they said, well, they waffled. And then you find out that the smart meter you've got from British Gas won't work with, I went to Ecotricity, and Ecotricity couldn't use the smart meter that British Gas had put in. So we've now changed to a company called Green Energy, who put in a new smart meter and have a tariff that has got four rates at different times of the day and night. So you can energy shift. So as well as reducing and being more efficient of the way you live so that you use less power, you can also shift some of the power so that you know, wind turbines continue to turn at night time, so there is a lot of spare capacity on the grid at night time. So on one of our electric cars, we've got a, when do you want to recharge this car, set the time, so easy, 11:30 at night. I think the tariff then is 4.99p per kilowatt hour. Brilliant. The other electric car, which we've had a bit longer, the bit that does that is greyed out, and then you find that you've got to pay Renault £160 to upgrade some software, and you think, no. But anyway, there are, so as well as, you know, insulation and energy efficient appliances and living more simply and using bicycles around here is tricky, because the roads are smaller. It is safer cycling in central London. I don't know what Bristol's like, but I mean, around here the roads are quite small, and most people run around in sort of large cars, and it's not safe to cycle in most of the roads around here, which is a real shame. And the National Park Authority got £4 million to improve transport in the national park. So I thought, brilliant, more cycle lanes. But they haven't used it for a single cycle lane. And I'm not sure what they have used it for, but there is one cycle lane that goes from Lyndhurst to Totten. And I think that's been upgraded recently, and that's brilliant because you always see cyclists on it, and it's a really fast road, and it stops people being killed. And there should be cycle lanes between the local communities, because then you could cycle to work or you could cycle to school, and that doesn't happen around here. So you get people taking their children to school in cars, and if you try and go through Tiptoe or you try and go through Hordle schools at coming in or going out times, it is chaotic, and it's not good for the children, and it's not good for the community, and it could be done differently. So yeah, we are working with schools, and one of my colleagues is working with schools almost exclusively. But as part of that, they come to our solar field to see that it's possible and to see what it's like and to see that it's not threatening and it's not killing anything and it's not polluting anything and it's quiet and it's peaceful. Although the children can hear the inverters in the way that adults can't, because their hearing is even sharper. But it's only within 3 feet. You know, it's not exactly a loud noise. And yeah, that's... Yeah, so Transition Group is working, and a number of our members. We've got 453 members of the co-op and 50 bondholders. My Quaker meeting, I'm a Quaker, and that's one of the reasons I did this, because Quakers in 2011 decided to be a low-carbon, sustainable society. So I have shared my experience with the Quaker movement, and quite a few Quakers are part of our co-op. I keep coming across new ones and say, oh, by the way, because I'm okay at remembering names sometimes, but I can't remember 450 names of people I only meet once a year, and I only meet 100 of them each year. So, but there are people I come across, and I keep on coming across people who say, we didn't hear about your project and we would like to have invested in it, and have you got any other projects? And you think, we're on BBC TV 3 times, we're on BBC local radio, we're on Inside Out, we're in the local press, we had banners around the place, we had open days. How come you didn't hear about it? But it just proves that you don't get everyone by, even if you think you did. But I've got a long list of people who want to invest in the new project, and I haven't got a new project for them yet.